Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 167. Our guest this week is an author, an Andre Norton Award winner, a NES streamer and other consoles as well, a blogger. I think it's been a while, but a Star Trek blogger, in fact. We have Eugene Myers here, who goes under the pen name when writing, E.C. Myers. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, it has been a while since I blogged Star Trek, but my heart wants to go back to it.
Well, we can talk about that. But let's start with your nearly 500 NES games.
Yeah. Well, 500, I guess, licensed. If I fold in the homebrew, then I'm well over that.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been collecting really since I was a kid. I mean, the NES was my first console. I believe I got it in probably Christmas 1988. And so, you know, with my very first games, you know, Super Mario Brothers, and I think The Legend of Zelda shortly thereafter, Super Mario Brothers 2. I mean, I picked up those games as a kid. And, you know, like most kids, I think I got, you know, one or two a year that I could count on, you know, for birthdays and Christmas. And occasionally, I would get an extra game for good behavior, you know, if I got a good grade or something, or we just found one for sale used or whatever. And then when I went to college and got an actual job and lived near a Funko Land, if anybody remembers Funko Land, my collection really started to grow. So I've been actively collecting, since I was a kid, and certainly more in my adult years.
The games that you had from when you were a kid, are they the original ones you had, or did you like sell some and then get them again?
I have never sold a game. They are the original games. I still have some of the boxes. I should really have all of the boxes. I think they're buried at my mom's apartment somewhere. She moved at one point, and I'm hoping that the box that contained those folded up boxes is still there someplace, but I haven't been able to unearth it. But at least in theory, I have all of the boxes and the manuals and the inserts and everything. As a kid, those games were so precious to me. You know, getting one or two a year. You know, I always wanted to keep them pristine, so I kept the boxes, and I was really meticulous about everything. I had a real moment when I played Star Tropics. If you know Star Tropics, there is an insert with it. There's a letter that comes with the game, and at a certain point in the game tells you have to immerse it in water in order to proceed. And that I had to struggle with that one because I did not want to put this letter in water, but there was no other way to progress. So yeah, I still have that original collection, and I've just added to it over the years.
Do you have a formerly soggy letter?
I do still have that letter. And actually that one I do have. And it's very wrinkly, like it didn't dry, you know, perfect. I believe it will still work. I think if I immerse it again, it will probably still work. But of course, now that stuff is online, you know, you can just go to a GameFAQs, or I think Nintendo even has like the manual online, and they have, I know when they release it on like Virtual Console and things like that, it just flat out tells you, like, you need a code from this letter, and it will just flat out tell you will need this code, you know, which kind of ruins it a little bit. It was an interesting attempt at, no pun intended, immersing the gamer in the game, you know, like, oh, there's this like physical object that you have to interact with in order to progress in the video game. I assume it was probably a copy protection thing too, because I know that was a little bit more common with like PC games and things like that. But it was very unexpected for me as a kid.
Yeah, that's cool. As I said, you stream NES. You have something called NES Alphanumeric. You stream other consoles as well, but when you do your NES blind playthroughs, it's called NES Alphanumeric. And I have to ask where the name comes from. I don't suspect this is where, but my favorite show of all time is Reboot, and one of the characters would yell Alphanumeric when he thought something was cool.
Mark, that is exactly where the name came from.
Oh, wow.
that is one of my favorite shows of all time as well. I'm actually looking directly at an Enzo figure that I have next to my CRT. It's absolutely from Alphanumeric. That was definitely one of my favorite shows as a kid.
That's awesome.
And and it came to me, you know, I knew I wanted to do the games in alphabetical order. You know, some of them have numbers in them, and I always liked the phrase, you know, alphanumeric or stay frosty, and you know, all those catchphrases from the show. So it was just kind of like I wanted to put do something unusual and show another fandom, you know, that I'm a part of, and just, you know, I can't think of anything else that conveys that much enthusiasm about something. So,
oh well, that is amazing. We're starting off on the right foot.
I toyed with the idea of starting with starting a stream with the incoming game sound effect.
Oh, yeah.
From Reboot, which would have made it obvious, you know, very obvious what the influence was, but I could never find like a really clean capture of that, you know, without too much like busy stuff going on, because when one of those games would descend on the city, like all heck would break loose, and you know, so I didn't go with that. So it's a little Easter egg for folks like you who share my love of Reboot.
So you're over 300 games in, I think.
Yes,
Pardon me.
Yeah, I'm actually winding it up. I'm at 330 something. I should know it. I think 338 maybe.
But if you got over 500 games, how are we almost winding it up?
So the premise of the NES Alphanumeric was to play every game that I own, a physical copy of, that I have never played before or only played for a few minutes. You know, like you get a game and you pop it in and you can't get past the first screen, or so that was my experience with Darkman when I got it in college. So any game that I didn't really sit down and actually try to play, right? So that's the premise. So I have a bunch of games that obviously I played a lot as a kid. Many of them I had beaten as a kid, so those didn't count. Like I didn't stream as part of that series. I didn't stream Super Mario Brothers 3 or The Legend of Zelda or things like that. So I think what ended up is a lot of the really, you know, well-known games like Battletoads didn't come up in the cycle, and I ended up focusing on stuff that, you know, you don't usually see people streaming, like Bigfoot, which is not a good game, or, you know, things like Worm, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and things like that. So it was kind of nice to feature games that people haven't encountered that much, you know. Conquest of the Crystal Palace, or like Jackie Chan's Action Kung Fu. Some of those games, you know, have been in my collection since I got them in college, and some of them were more recent acquisitions when I got back into collecting. And, you know, a lot of people didn't really see you streaming them that often. And I really enjoyed, and part of that was also I really enjoy seeing somebody attempt a game for the first time and figure it out and just get that fresh reaction to it, like, oh, how do you jump, or like, what's going on with this, or, you know, these controls are really janky, or oh, that's really interesting. Like, I like seeing those first reactions to things, and, you know, whether that's of interest to my viewers or not, you know, I like sharing that experience, you know, and kind of capturing it.
Well, speaking of your viewers, your son asked you for your YouTube channel and subscribed to it. And I know you said in the post where you mentioned this, that good thing you keep it family friendly. But did anything go through your head? Were you like kind of running back like, oh, what have I got on there?
So the only thing that gave me a little bit of pause or a little bit of regret, I guess, is I occasionally talk about him. And especially with the earlier streams, you know, I started streaming when he was still pretty young, I think about a year and a half old. You know, I might be saying, oh, he's, you know, I would explain, you know, why I was late to the stream, because he wouldn't go to sleep, or I know there are lots of streams where I'd be in the middle of playing the game and I would see him kind of sneaking, like skulking in the shadows, thinking that I can't see him. You know, he had gone to bed, but he was now coming downstairs to see like what I was doing. And I probably expressed some frustration. You know, it was just, it's a very honest, you know, accounting of my life. You know, it's kind of in some sense, it's kind of nice to go back and see that, you know, but my earliest streams were really only about an hour long, because and many of them ended when I heard him crying on the baby monitor and I would say, okay, I gotta go, you know. So it's kind of an interesting progression for sure. And I, you know, hopefully I didn't say anything. I don't think I would ever say anything, you know, really negative about him. I think they're all just like honest experiences of a parent, and sometimes a frustrated parent or a very tired parent, you know, who just wants to play a game for a couple of hours without an interruption, you know.
Yeah. Has he given you any feedback? Like, does he come to you, he's, you know, been, I don't like this, or I do like this?
He hasn't commented on it in that sense. He started watching some of my Cuphead streams. We actually have been playing Cuphead a little bit, which is an experience. I call it extra hard mode, playing with an 8-year-old who he's still really learning to play a game like that. He's gotten really, really good at it, though. And actually, he's playing right now downstairs. I had to set it up for him on the Steam Deck. And but he when we would play a boss together, sometimes it had been a while since I had played it and streamed it. So I would go back to the video to see like what I did, you know, and I would show him, okay, like this is how I beat it. And then also to kind of show him again, like, you know, he was trash talking me for a while when we started out, you know, cause I would mess up, but I would mess up because I was trying to help him, or unbeknownst to me, he was stealing my hit points. Like when you play a 2-player game in Cuphead, the other player, if they die, they can come back into the match, but they take one of the surviving player's hit points. And I didn't realize that. I thought there was some bug in the game, or he was playing on some special easy mode that let him come back into the game. And I was suddenly surprised. Like, I would be trying to get up to the last phase of the fight with full hit points so that I could beat them. But and I would think that I had made it all the way to the end, and suddenly he's back and I was like, I have one hit point left. I was like, what happened? Like, I guess I got hit and I didn't notice it or whatever. But anyway, he would be kind of raw with some of his commentary, and I'd be like, I'm the only person in this room who has actually finished this game like on my own. Like, you know, so here's video of my, you know, my accomplishment. But so he started looking at some of my Cuphead videos on his own when he found my channel, and he commented a couple days later. He's like, oh, you were talking about me, like how you were saying that your shoulder hurt because I would climb into the bed with you and I would be kind of like scrunched up, or, you know, I did not sleep well when he was in the bed with us, and he was coming to the bed pretty often. And so I probably did talk about like why I had neck pain that night or whatever. And I felt bad about it. Like, I was like, you know, what have I been saying? You know, I hope I don't make him feel bad about it. But he seemed okay with it. Like, he was just commenting. It's also probably not anything I wouldn't have said to his face. Like, you know, kid, when you sleep in the bed with us, you know, it's not very comfortable.
Right. Do you still cap your NES purchases at $70-ish? Or is there any game that you would break that rule for?
That is still kind of the upwards limit, like around there, like 70, 75. And actually, some of the homebrew games that I've been picking, actually, you know what? I think I broke that with, I bought the Garbage Pail Kids homebrew release that came out recently from Retrotainment. And I think the version I got was like $80, but it was like, it's like a brand new game. But yeah, that tends to be my target. I, you know, a friend of mine was offering me, he was selling some of his games, and he was selling, I just blanked out on the title. Man, what's that thing called? It's, yeah, I don't remember the title now, which it doesn't, it's probably still sitting next to my NES, in fact. Oh, yeah, I don't remember. Anyway, he was selling it for it was a good price, but it was over my limit, and I told him my limit, and see, he actually came down on it a little bit to move the game and probably do me a favor as well. So I streamed it recently too. I could probably just look it up.
Well, speaking of that,
oh, it's the whatchamacallit, Cryon Conquest. Yeah,
I am unfamiliar.
Yeah, it's a game that was released in Japan as the Magical Dorothy, right? But Cryon Conquest is basically a Mega Man clone, and it's very, very hard. At least the North American release of it is very, very hard. The Famicom one has like unlimited continues and passwords and things like that. And the NES game, they just stripped all of that out. But I had wanted that game because it looked really cool. And he made me an offer I couldn't refuse on that one.
You have a story similar to something that's happened to me, but I've mentioned it on air before, so I'm not going to bore people with my story again. But years ago, you went retro shopping in Denver with Nefarious Wes, and it was documented on their channel. And you bought Millipede for NES for $5, but you both wanted it. Did it come to blows? Where was it? Did you have to like do rock paper scissors or something?
No, I don't think that was an issue. I think I gave him some other game.
You gave him Smash TV.
Yeah, I gave him some other game. You know, it wasn't a big fight. Also, that's like a common enough game that you know, I don't think it would have been an issue. If it was something like, oh, we found, you know, Little Samson for $25, I want that. Like, I think we probably would have some kind of an epic battle to figure out who's gonna claim that one. But yeah, like to your question, I think if I would break that rule if it was like a ridiculously good deal. Like if it was something like I saw Panic Restaurant for sale for like $90. Like, okay, like I would do that, you know, but I'm not actively seeking those higher priced NES games because I've kind of like marked them off as like unobtainable. But if I did happen to see a legitimate copy somewhere for sale at a reasonable price, yeah, I'd probably make that call.
You have reviewed quite a few third-party NES controllers. Do any of them stand up to the original?
The modern third-party controllers, not really. I would say like my favorite third-party controller is an older one that you can still buy like on eBay. It's the Hudson Joy Card Sansui SSS, right? So it's a gray controller. It looks like a Famicom controller, but it's a little bit thicker and like wider, and it's gray instead of red, and so it feels like it was designed for an adult to hold it. It also has turbo functions in it, and it has kind of a unique feature where you can actually feed your you can plug it into the audio output of your NES, and you can pipe sound through a headphone jack in the controller. And it's supposed to create like a stereo sound effect, which really is kind of distracting because what it does is when you press the right on the D-pad, then sound is louder in the right side of your headphones. And if you press left, then it's louder on the left side. So it's this weird, I wouldn't call it stereo, but it's some kind of weird soundscape that they were trying to create. That is the most comfortable NES controller. It's the one I use pretty much on all of my streams. But for modern controllers, I think some of the 8-bit do controllers are pretty good. It really depends on the D-pad. And unfortunately, there's also variation with a lot of modern controllers where you might get one controller that's great, and then you get the same controller but right. You know, at a different time, and there's the quality control is not there, or a controller will be great and then like 3 months later it'll be less great, you know. So some of them don't really hold up the quality under constant use. So it's kind of one of those drawbacks where you see people reviewing products online and they'll try it out, you know, for their video, but you don't really know, like, real world, I've been using this controller constantly for 3 months. Is it still as good as it was when I got it, you know, compared to an NES controller that I've been using for 20 years, you know, that's still pretty good if all the contacts and everything are still good. So, but that's probably true of most reviews. You know, you hardly ever get that check-in, you know, later on. Sometimes you'll get a, you know, 1 year later, do I still recommend this? That kind of thing. Yeah, the third-party controllers from back in the day are still pretty solid.
Switching gears, sort of. You're writing. Obviously, video games, they get, I wouldn't say, maybe not influence your writing, but certainly, I mean, you have a short story, The Land of the Morning Calm, which is about a ghost trapped inside of an MMO. And you've been a writer for the Ruby series and for Lies and Liberty in World of Warcraft, Folk and Fairy Tales of Azeroth. My first question for that stuff, when you get to write something for such an established franchise like Ruby and World of Warcraft, what are like the lore parameters that are given to you? Like, obviously you can't go in and be like, oh, it turns out Arthas was faking it and he's actually a good guy.
Yeah. They are rightfully very protective of the intellectual property and being consistent with you know, the pre-established canon, you know, and the fans, I think, would also be paying really close attention to that sort of thing. So you know, you generally have to get all your ideas. Either they give you an idea and they want you to write you know, something along those lines, or if you come up with an idea, you really have to get it vetted to make sure that it fits within the scope of the series or the game, and that it doesn't contradict anything. Like, I always try to build on what came before, right? Like, I look at that the existing material as canon, that is the first source, and I want to build on that. And if I can work around, like, the gaps, like, okay, well, there's, you know, you have this scene and then you have this scene, but we don't necessarily, they've never established what happened between those two moments, then I feel fine kind of writing in between there and filling in the gaps and maybe connecting them a little bit. And what I really try to do is add to the world in some way, if I can, especially, I think with Ruby, like, really just, okay, well, we've never seen this in the show. They probably never will show this in the show by the time the series ends. Can I do something with that? Can we establish something around that? So yeah, but they you know, they look over all the drafts, and some of them, you know, certainly with Blizzard properties, you know, they have the game teams looking at the material to make sure that it's consistent with what came before, and also what they've got planned that I may not be really privy to. You know, they want to make sure that it doesn't contradict anything, and it doesn't repeat anything, I think, necessarily as well, you know.
Yeah, I wonder if there's ever, I'm sure this has probably happened, but I wonder if someone, like, submits a book and they're reading it and they're like, oh no, this is, like, exactly the expansion we have coming up.
So it does happen. With Ruby, I have a pretty interesting track record of coming up with an idea that they then tell me I have to change because it's either exactly the same as something else, or it's similar enough to something else that that they've been planning. Or even sometimes just an idea that they think might be the case, you know, that they want to not close the door on just yet. And so I'll have to change the details a little bit so that I don't take away from something that they've been working on. I think they look at that as, like, a testament to, like, how well I know the material, because it would make sense for me to come up with some similar ideas to, like, what they have come up with, you know, and that they're planting things in the show that they, you know, are going to deliver on later on as well, you know. So hopefully it all works together. Yeah, absolutely.
And you do know the material. Before you auditioned for the Ruby books, you binged the show to get a feel for it. But then for The Silence of Six, you never read the original screenplay before writing your book. Is one approach better than the other? Does it depend on the project, or, like, how does that happen?
Well, I think it depends on the project. With Ruby, it was essential. Like, I was going to be writing something set in their world using characters that they had created, and I needed to make sure that I knew the rules of that world. I knew how the characters would interact, especially the main characters interacting with the characters that I was working with. I needed to get a flavor for it, you know, and I needed... And with The Silence of Six, it was a little bit different in that, like, I did ask for the screenplay, but they didn't want to give it to me, and they recommended that I not read it. And so that was written for a company that is now defunct, called Adaptive Studios, and their whole MO was to take abandoned intellectual property and turn it into other stuff, right? So The Silence of Six originated as a screenplay that had been optioned, and it was supposed to be produced, but it was ultimately never made. So they bought that screenplay, and they wanted to turn the screenplay into a young adult novel. The original story was just an adult kind of political thriller, and they wanted to turn it into a young adult thriller. And so they, you know, I never saw the script, but they wanted me to, I think, take a sort of a fresher approach to it. So they gave me some elements that they had distilled from the screenplay that they wanted to carry out in the novel. And I did a little bit of my own detective work and just kind of Googled, and I did find a like an announcement, probably in Variety or something like that, for when that original screenplay was sold. So I had, like, the very barest of blurbs as to what it originally was, and the original premise was similar to the start of you know, sort of like the inciting incident from the novel that I wrote, but you know, I assume everything else is very different. And you know, mine ended up being about teenage hacktivists, and it was very kind of steeped in geek culture and hacker culture and what was kind of contemporary current events. You know, it was around when Edward Snowden had you know, revealed information about government surveillance and things like that, and all of that sort of fed into what I was writing.
Is there a video game franchise? I mean, we already talked about World of Warcraft, but is there a video game franchise that's like a dream for you to turn into a novel?
You know, a recent one, I've been playing Grounded with some friends, which is essentially Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, you know, where you play as kids who wake up in a backyard and you're very small and you have to figure out what happened and how to, you know, get turned back to your normal size. And it has a really cool backstory that is revealed through tapes, kind of Bioshock-like, where you're sort of getting the journal entries of the scientist who did this to you, and things clearly went very wrong for him as well, and you're piecing things together and trying to collect like the components that you need in order to like fix a machine that can hopefully make you normal again. So it's got a very cool story, and I would love to write something in that universe. I think they're supposed to be working on an animated series. I don't know if that's still happening or not, but there, it seems pretty rich. Like that there would be lots of opportunities to write some really cool stories, either set with those characters or other characters, or, you know, some kind of tangential IP.
So you've written, you know, obviously young adult novels, short stories, you blog, you're a streamer, you've done radio shows or podcast shows, I guess, at Realm FM. You've done all this media. When are we going to get a game written by E.C. Meyers?
That would be cool. You know, I'm working on, very slowly, I've been working on a kind of an NES homebrew project with some folks who are kind of building a module or like a way to create a sort of a choose your own adventure story that could run on the NES. And they approached me to kind of help them work on that and sort of provide a story. So right now I'm not really, I don't know that I'm necessarily writing like whatever that story would be, but I'm sort of doing a proof of concept story that uses that system to kind of see how it works and, you know, how they can refine the tool and things like that, which is also a dream of mine. Like, I'd love to write a choose your own adventure book, which is sort of a, you know, paper-based kind of game. But yeah, I mean, I'd love to write for games. You know, they have very different demands and requirements and skills. I have some friends who have written for games like Remnant from the Ashes and things like that, and they seem to enjoy it, and I would love to contribute to that. But you know, I think it would be a matter of the right property and, you know, just coming together. Like, I'd love to do that.
I know you don't like cliffhangers. Are there any that stand out to you in any kind of media as like really frustrating?
Oh boy, I mean, this is probably why I don't like cliffhangers. And so going way, 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 way back to my childhood, Alf. I don't know if you've ever seen Alf.
I have seen Alf, yes.
I was a big fan of Alf growing up. And that show ends, season four of the show is canceled. And in the last episode, Alf is supposed to, he's trying to contact his friends to come and pick him up so they can, you know, he can leave Earth. And as he's waiting for the ship, the alien task force arrives, surrounds him and his family, the Tanners, and his friends take off. Like they don't even land. And that's how the show says, like, to be continued, and it was never continued as a TV series. It just ended, and it was kind of continued as a movie, which was not good. Mm-hmm. Later on, but things like that, I think I was probably affected by TV shows the most. Like Quantum Leap ended not really on a cliffhanger, but with an unresolved ending, I thought. So I think I was probably scarred by some of those experiences, and as a reader, I don't like reading a book and getting to the end and discovering that was only like half the story. Like, it's fine if the story continues in the next book, right? But I want that one book to feel complete in some way. It has to come to some sort of resolution for the character or for the world. They have to achieve some sort of goals. And I've read books where that first book was clearly just the setup for the next book, you know, and then you have to wait, what, 2 years or something for the next one to come out. That's difficult, you know, for me. I don't want to put other readers in that kind of a situation if I can help it.
Right. Would it be fair in a, you know, I agree with you, obviously the book needs to stand on its own, but maybe instead of likening that kind of thing to a series finale, like a season finale, you know, a cliffhanger there obviously makes some sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I absolutely had to do that with the you know, some of the book series that I've written. They kind of wanted to be a little bit open-ended, right? So you can have a conclusion to the main events of this particular story, but you kind of want to tease like what might come next at the very least, right? So whether you consider that a cliffhanger or not, it's something that might not ever get resolved. Like I was asked to add a cliffhanger ending to Against All Silence, which the sequel to The Sons of Six, which I did not want to do, but I did it. And we never got to write a third book, right?
Right.
I was working on a podcast, serialized podcast, like you mentioned, for Realm, which was called Remade. And that ends on a cliffhanger because the shows were developed as seasons of a TV show. That was basically how they were created. So we would plan out that whole season and, you know, we would leave it with kind of a cliffhanger. Theoretically, you'd be coming back. We never got to complete that story. I did another one called Alternus, which is about characters being trapped in kind of a virtual reality video game. Well, they're not trapped, but they're participating in a virtual reality video game in which other countries are also participating. And this is how they kind of resolve global conflicts. They do it within a game instead of in the real world. They treat it as like a contest. And we never got to resolve that one. And so all of those incomplete stories kind of eat away at me on some level, you know, like I want to go back to finish them, but those decisions aren't up to me.
It's interesting to hear that perspective from the writer of the, you know, of the thing. As you know, obviously the readers are like, oh, and you know, Game of Thrones is obviously a very famous, like, when is this going to be finished? Slightly different scenario, I guess, but it's interesting to hear that the writer may be the one as well going like, ah, I wish I could finish this.
Oh, absolutely. Like, we had planned out what was going to happen in both of those series. And, I keep thinking maybe I should pitch to them, like, let's just do like a sort of a movie version of this, like just to wrap up the storyline. They haven't completely, they haven't flat out told me, oh, this show isn't going to continue. But, you know, we also haven't been working on them. So it's unfortunate. I really would like to go back and finish those. But, you know, I'm here. If I can fit it into my schedule, I'd be happy to return to those.
Well, that's somewhat of a segue returning to the Star Trek blog, theviewscreen.com. I think 2014 is the last time there was a post there. Going through it, there's some great... I like how you tagged a lot of the posts. It was you and I believe a friend... Tori, I should have written her last name.
Tori Atkinson, yeah.
Thank you. And some of the tags are things like Troy is useless, or fully clothed man wrestling, hand waving mumble mumble, wibbly wobbly timey wimey. I'm also a Doctor Who fan, so I like that one. but very cool. You said you would be interested in returning to that. Is that something?
We keep talking about doing it. It is not dead. It has been on a very, very long hiatus. So 2014 coincides with the birth of my son, and I got very, very busy. And I also was writing, The Silence of Six and Against All Silence in that time period. So I got really busy, and you know, as much fun as the blog is. So it's a weekly, it was a weekly blog for folks who don't know what it is, where we were rewatching, it was called the Star Trek Rewatch. We would rewatch Star Trek episodes. And it originated as the original series. We used to blog it at tor.com, and then we kind of continued it on our own site. But the initial setup for it was Tori had not seen most of the original Star Trek series, and I had seen them many times because I'm a pretty strong Trekkie, and so we would kind of bring different things to it. So it was a rewatch for me, and for her, some of the time it was a first watch, and we would give our reactions to it, provide a little bit of context for the show, like when it came out and what was going on and like what might have informed it and things like that and how it fits in the series and all of that. And then when we completed that run and the original series movies, we moved on to Star Trek The Next Generation, and we finally did get to season three. We got to some of the really good episodes, and then we got very busy. So that the really unfortunate thing was that the episodes were getting really good, and it was a part of Star Trek The Next Generation that we enjoyed, and we just haven't gone back to it. And occasionally, one of us will mention it. We're keeping the site running. One of us will mention it, and we haven't, I don't think, we haven't overcome the inertia yet to get it going. But I have written another review that's sitting in the queue, so I feel like in some ways it's in Tori's court. But you know, we just need to kind of prioritize again. It's not paid work. We did it just for fun and for the community. Like, we liked having those weekly discussions with Star Trek fans, some of the debates and the conversations that were going on, and also just having the excuse to, you know, rewatch Star Trek. So I, you know, it's not an abandoned project, but it certainly has been on a really long break.
Was there anything in your rewatch that made you like, huh, I didn't catch that the first time, or like, this is worse or better than I remember?
There was plenty of that, especially when you start looking into some of the trivia, you know, behind the scenes stuff. There were things though that even some of the bad episodes, you can kind of look at them and appreciate them in a different way. With the original series, I think looking at it as I originally watched most of those when I was a kid, and so coming back to them as an adult who has a little bit more experience and has seen more and read more, having a greater appreciation for things like how some of those old episodes were filmed, like the lighting that they did and sort of like what informed that. You know, it's the production quality that doesn't have anything to do with the special effects, that has everything to do with, you know, the cinematography, that aspect of it, like appreciating them on a different level that way. And then there were things where, you know, there were episodes that, like The Way to Eden, which was basically the episode with the space hippies coming to the Enterprise. You know, I had always said I was never going to watch that episode again, and then I had to because I had to do it for the rewatch. And that's still a really bad episode. No, don't intend to watch that again. The best thing, one of the most fun things we did as part of that rewatch was, if you know, like Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Riff Tracks. We recorded essentially our own version of Riff Tracks for the episode Spock's Brain, right? So an infamous episode of the series where Spock's brain is taken and his body is left behind by these aliens. And so Dr. McCoy is kind of operating him with a remote control until they can reunite him with his brain. And then he has to reconnect Spock's brain with Spock telling him how to do it. So it is a ridiculous episode. I can't say that I necessarily recommend it except for its camp value, but we decided to record this Riff Tracks, and it's one of the most rewarding things we've done. It was really fun, but it was so much work, and that's one of the first times I had some inkling of how difficult it is for like what you do creating a podcast. I know you say you try not to edit it too much, but even just getting, you know, the audio levels right, or we had to cut out like dead air and things like that. It's meticulous work, you know, that has to be done in real time for the most part. So that was interesting. And so that's the only one we ever did because it was just so time consuming, you know, and I don't know if there was a better way to do it, but we had to watch the episode, you know, seven or eight times making jokes, writing down the jokes, and then recording the audio so that we could time the jokes to the scenes. And then I had to kind of come in and I had to edit it, make sure everything synced up. And oh my gosh, it was a lot of work, but it was fun.
Cool. What VHS tapes do you still own?
Oh man,
if it's too long a list, you can just give a couple of the gems.
No, so I don't have a lot of commercial releases of things, but I have VHS tapes, like commercial tapes of stuff like Earthworm Jim and Mighty Max and
Mighty Max. No, there's a show that I, as a kid, I hated the ending. I loved it and hated it because it's the only show that like set itself up to just go on reruns.
Yes, I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was like very clever that they basically reset the show so that there was an excuse for reruns. Exactly. As much as you would want there to be an actual resolution to it, that was, I thought, a stroke of genius. It was also a hard episode to watch. Like I think everybody dies like in some kind of like distressing ways, you know, for a kid's show. Like you don't usually watch a kid's show for, you know, 30 or 40 episodes, however long it is, and then one of the main characters is killed, you know,
and then doomed to repeat it forever, I guess.
And then doomed to repeat it. Well, I'm sure he'll get it right next time,
right?
You know, Rob Paulson, he'll take care of business. So I have some of the Marsupilami, like I have some random like commercial tapes that I bought, you know, that I have, like that I probably got cheap from Blockbuster. But then the tapes that I actually still own, I kept some. Weirdly, I kept some. I used to have thousands of tapes, right? Because stuff that I recorded off of TV and things that I did in tape trades and full runs of TV series, things like that. And then when we moved from New York to Philadelphia, I had to purge a ton of it. And that was kind of around when DVDs were ubiquitous and coming down in price, you know, it was and compact. So it seemed like, okay, if I can actually replace this on DVD, you know, I should, because it'll be better quality and it'll take up like the footprint of, you know, 26 VHS tapes compared to six DVD box sets, say for like a Star Trek series. You can't compare that, you know? So I got rid of a ton of those things and then stuff that I thought I might replace in the future, or things that I had already converted. Like I had copied all of my like Darkwing Duck and DuckTales tapes to DVD before they announced an official release of them. And I was like, okay, well I can part with these now because I've preserved them, you know, in quotations. There's stuff that I kept, like I did keep Mighty Max. I have also like a full run of the series that I recorded off of like probably TBS or wherever it was airing that I've been meaning to convert to DVD. But there's also like less incentive to do that. All that stuff is on YouTube now, probably, you mm-hmm. know, where you can find, you know, bootleg DVDs pretty cheaply. So I kept some stuff for sentimental value, which is kind of silly, but just stuff that I recorded that I rewatched many times, or some of the tapes have like other things on them, like, you know, that I recorded off the air that I didn't want to lose. You know, somewhere. So one of my Darkwing Duck tapes, this I regret. One of the Darkwing Duck tapes had the ending of Battletoads on it. When I played Battletoads, and I had a pretty good. I got up to the Dark Queen for the first time. I was like, I need to record this, right? I don't know if I'll ever get back up to this battle again. So I just started recording on one of those one of the tapes that was in the VCR, which was a tape that I was recording Darkwing Duck on. And I beat the game. And so that's the only evidence that I have that I beat this game when I was, you know, 13 or whatever. And it's gone. I don't know where that tape is. I think when I copied them to DVD, I think I gave all the tapes to a friend. And I'm sure it's just lost to time. But every now and then I poke around in one of my boxes to see if it's in there. Because I can't imagine I would have given that tape away. But I must have done. So some of those tapes, but I condensed like a collection of thousands down to I've probably got like three or four boxes worth of VHS tapes now.
Yeah, I think I've got a couple similar to you, like just like nostalgia kind of. I definitely have the Robin Hood animated movie, which I sometimes look at and I'm like, I'm never gonna own a VCR again. I don't know why I have this. But the box
I may have an extra
nice.
One. I may have an extra if you need one. I think we have maybe three VCRs, two or three. One of them's my wife's. And I
do appreciate that's very nice. I do appreciate it, but I should also say I don't think I'll ever hook up a VCR again.
Yeah. I get that. I pretty much only hook them up when I'm converting tapes. I have some tapes that like my mother-in-law asked me to convert as well, so I've done that. But it's not really hooked up. I have a Laserdisc player. It's not really hooked up. I actually need to repair my Laserdisc player because neither of them is working. And I have a DVD recorder that you can actually burn. You can record things to the hard drive and then burn it onto a DVD all in one unit. Like they definitely don't make those anymore. And I think they only made them for a very short period of time because I think that people didn't like that you could do that. But that thing I still have. The last time I checked it, I looked at it a couple years ago. I think maybe I pulled it out of storage and was like, maybe I copied that Battletoads thing onto this drive and it's still on here. And all I found on it was like episodes of Smallville that were recorded like off the air. Cause what I'd do is I would record them and then I would edit the commercials out and then I would, you know, and then I'd like, dump them to a DVD or a VHS tape or whatever. So there's just episodes of the original run of Smallville from the CW with like all the commercials and everything on there. It's just the whole drive is filled with them for some reason.
Well, I think we're pretty much going to wrap it up there. Can we tell anyone what's on the horizon? Can you tell us any book you're working on or what to expect from the next alphanumeric? What's going on?
Yeah, so Alphanumeric's easy. I have like two or three more games that I've never played before that I'm going to be running through in the next few weeks. And then I think I will probably segue into doing homebrew NES games because I have a pretty large homebrew NES collection. And I probably will intersperse that with Famicom cartridges, which I've recently started collecting, and probably just like maybe some miscellaneous NES games. I think I've been streaming the NES on Wednesday nights and I've been doing that consistently for like almost, you know, 6 years or so. So I think I'm going to continue with that theme. But I'll probably mix it up a little bit. I might revisit some old NES games that I've played that I've streamed previously and see if I can beat them, you know, on stream. Things like that. And then as far as the books go, I can tell you in sort of the vaguest of terms, because things are still kind of being worked out or they haven't been announced properly or they haven't been announced yet. The book that I've completed is coming out sometime in 2024, and it's a media tie-in to a video game series that people would know that has been delayed. So the book has also been delayed to match that. But it's a middle grade book, and it's completed. I have to actually do a couple light revisions this weekend, but then I will be done of it. And that's been a fun thing to work on, and hopefully there'll be another book in that series. I'd love to write another one. And then I have two other books that the contract is still being worked out. But they're also both middle grade books, and they're also both video game related. So the main characters in them are gamers, and so that those are going to be fun. I've already written parts of both of those books because that was kind of part of the pitch, and they're both going to be a ton of fun to write. One of them's going to be science fiction. One of them's going to be kind of contemporary fiction. But I'm not sure. Those both might be out in 2024. I'm not really sure because I'm still waiting on the contract. So those might not be out for a while yet. I'm not positive. But everything is video game related coming up, which is great. I mean, I love gaming, and I think that passion shows through in my writing when I'm talking about something that I enjoy that much. And I think that is also one of the reasons why I was, you know, invited to work on these projects, because they are all like other, you know, intellectual property. And then I've got, you know, my own books that I've been working on and that I should be working on more. One of them is also gaming related, but that would be my own story. So if I write something on my own, you know, on spec, they call it, like, you know, it's because, those have had like less priority for me because I don't know if I'll actually sell it. Like I write the book, my agent sends it out. It may sell, it may not sell. And if it doesn't sell, then I've spent, you know, 6 or 7 months writing a book that's not going to be published. And, you know, I think that with the tie-in books that I've been doing and the work for hire books that I've been writing, you know, they hire me to write this thing. it is definitely going to come out. It may not come out soon, but there's a higher chance that it's going to come out, and I will definitely be paid as well. So,
cool. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, if people want to keep up with you, they can go to your website, ecmyers, M-Y-E-R-S.net. You can also find you on YouTube at ecmyersvids. Eugene Myers, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.